right, let's get started. Today I want to talk to you about some of the varieties of medieval literature. For one thing, literature gives us a pretty good view of what ages in the past thought about themselves, what their ideals were, what a lot of their values and concepts were. And this is very revealing in medieval literature. Now, it comes in a lot of varieties. And the first variety is one called the Chanson du Geste, or the Song of Deed, the most famous of which is the Song of Roland. There were a lot of these written, and they are basically epic poems, which are meant to be sung to a lute, an instrument of this nature. And all of these happen to work around the basic setting of the court of Charlemagne. This is the theme, and the basic theme of the Chanson du Geste is always feudal in nature. That is, it is the loyalty of the knights to their overlord, and loyalty plays an extremely important role in this. It's also notable that a good many of them have a basic religious aspect in that they often deal with wars against heretics, unbelievers, Mohammedans, this kind of factor. Certainly this is central to the Song of Roland, where Roland and his friend Oliver are the two most eminent knights of the court of Charlemagne. And the story itself deals with Charlemagne's venture down into northern Spain, and the retreat of the rear guard through the pass of Roncesvalles, where they are cut off. In the song itself, they're cut off, of course, by the Saracens, and Roland is killed there, fighting to the death in that pass of Roncesvalles. In actual history, it wasn't the Saracens who defeated them, Paul, but guerrilla mountaineers who attacked them. The poems are not always historically accurate, though they almost always stem from some actual historical fact. It's notable in this, for instance, that one of the leading figures is a bishop, and he is a fighting bishop. He is a warrior bishop in this, not just a churchman at all. And that's par for the course. It's also notable that women play no role in this at all. There is one woman named in this. This is the girl who is betrothed to Roland. She occurs in the poem only when his death is announced to her and she faints dead away. Exit women. It is a limited role, to say the least. And this is one of the things that is going to undergo a very sharp change in the very next form of literature. Because the next form of literature that comes up, the Chanson du Geste type starts in the 11th century, perhaps about 1050, and flourishes up to, through roughly the first quarter of the 12th century. Then you have something called troubadour verse that begins to appear on the scene. And troubadour verse is concerned with various aspects, the most important of which is a series of love songs to a lady. So women now appear very sharply and precisely en scène, but in a very particular role. The other things the troubadours are apt to do are to have war poems, poems to encourage people into battle, and a series of poems dedicated to the Virgin Mary. And indeed, this is the period when the cult of the Virgin becomes all important in Europe, particularly in France. Up to this time, churches have mainly been dedicated to saints, to local saints, to specific saints, to Christ, to the Trinity, something of this nature. All of a sudden, they begin to be dedicated to the Virgin, until one begins to think that Notre Dame is simply another name for a church or a cathedral, because so many are dedicated to Our Lady. And, of course, the troubadours begin, the earliest one known is in from southern France, from Aquitaine, and he is the Duke, Duke William the Ninth of Aquitaine, who is in fact the grandfather of your old friend Eleanor of Aquitaine. He's the very first one known, and he starts the writing of these love poems. Now these flourish, particularly down in southern France, at the court of Aquitaine, at the court of Toulouse, and this is where the whole variety of poems starts. There is a particular kind of pattern that goes with this. The poems themselves, in large part, celebrate the beauty, the charm, the desirability of a specific lady. And each troubadour tends to tie himself up to a particular lady, and he celebrates her beauty, her charm, her desirability at her court, but also, if he goes wandering away from there, he still remains true to this one lady. Now, there are all kinds of special poems. There are poems that you sing to her in the evening. There are poems you sing to her at dawn. All times of day are celebrated, but they all go around that same subject of the enormous desirability of this one superb lady. Now she stands on a pedestal. You are eternally paying court to her, and you are eternally getting nowhere with her. This is the essential that goes with troubadour verse. She is basically untouchable. She exists as a supreme ideal, and indeed, by what develops, in fact, is a whole way of life about this. And but you must continually devote yourself to celebrating this lady, and you must eternally be wanting to get somewhere with her. She must consistently fend you off. She will indeed, at times, be quite cruel to you. She'll make you leave her court to make sure that you will continue to be true. The worst of all things she can do to you is to put you to a terrible trial where you are both actually in one bed together all night, and you must never touch her. If you do, she screams bloody murder, and the guards come in, and all hell breaks loose. The very essence of this is the untouchability of this extraordinary woman on the pedestal. And indeed, so clearly is this ingrained in people that there is, for example, a case history of a troubadour who for 10 years paid court to this particular lady. And he wrote poem after poem, sang to her in the morning, he sang to her at dawn, he sang to her in the evening, he sang to her at midday. Gosh, he couldn't get away from it. Finally, she said, okay. And he said, okay. What the hell do you mean, okay? You don't say okay to me. What the hell kind of lady are you? You're no damn good. He stomps off in a rage. End of that story. That was not done. This is the very essence of it. It should remain untouchable through all of it. So you have this extraordinary concept of the lady. Now, this exists only for noble women. It's true. And, of course, it exists at an absolute peak around her old friend, Eleanor of Aquitaine. She is one of the great patronesses of troubadours. There are special troubadours connected with her. And there are several other ladies down in the south, Adelaise Les Beaux and so on, who are equally the great patrons of this particular form of literature. And the form remains basically southern French. It's true that when Eleanor marries the King of France and goes to Paris, she will carry troubadours with her and will introduce the themes to northern France later when she's married to a King of England. The themes will be introduced to England. In fact, when she went on the Crusades, she carried troubadours, as you know, and introduced the theme into Constantinople as well. So she's very important in here. And Eleanor is one of those persons around whom a particular form took place. This is something called the Courts of Love. Now, the Courts of Love could only be called by very special ladies, Eleanor being one of them. She had to be prominent, had to have the money to support this kind of thing. an inadvertent love, what you did was to send out nuns across southern France. Set on, let us say, the 3rd of May or the 12th of April, you would hold a court of love in the castle at Bordeaux. And to this court could come anyone who was having real problems about love. And you could bring it in, brought literally to a trial. Now what you have is a dais at one end of the great hall, and the lady who is called it and her fellow ladies sit here as judges for the court. Then you have a whole group of troubadours who have arrived, prepared to play their roles. And in comes someone who's got a problem. And he presents his case before the ladies. And then the troubadours have to take up the cause. One of them will be the defendant, and one will be the prosecutor of this case. And they must then work out their arguments, and the arguments must, in fact, be sung to the lute, they're improvised, to the ladies. Once the ladies have heard the arguments on both sides, they retire, come to their decision, and they come back. Then also they must, in fact, improvise and sing the judgment on the case. Now, I'll give you some example, a couple of them, of the kind of case that's brought before a court of love, because we know some of these. They've been passed down. One, for instance, dealt with the unfortunate case of a man who is deeply in love with a lady, and he assumes that she is in love with him. They are, in fact, sitting side by side at a banquet, right? And they're holding hands. And everything seems nice until he notices that she is, in fact, giving the eye to a gentleman sitting on the other side of the table, and at the same time is playing footsie with a man who is directly across the table. This disturbs him very much, and he wants to know which of the three of them does she truly love. In other words, how do you express true love? With the hand, the eye, or the foot? A troubadour takes up the case of each one of these. One of them argues the hand, one of them argues the foot, one of them argues the eye, and so on. And the ladies then retire, and they come back, and they bring judgment that, in fact, the person that she really loves is the one she is giving the eye to. Because you can lie, you can hold any fool's hand and make him happy that way. It doesn't mean anything. You can play footsie with anybody, even if it does have rather overtones to it. And so that doesn't count. But the eye is the thing that always speaks the truth. You cannot control this. Your eye will go to the person you really, really love, and there you are. So that's the way it works. Now, the most famous of all the trials brought before a court of love was over, indeed, a very interesting problem. The question that is posed is true love possible between a man and a wife? Now, you must admit, that is a somewhat advanced problem for the 12th century. And it is argued at great length before the ladies. And there are great arguments in favor that, of course, the greatest of all love is between a husband and wife. And there are arguments that there can be no love. Remember, this is an age of arranged marriages, after all. And the decision is brought down by the ladies that, in fact, true love cannot exist between a man and his wife. That it cannot exist because love can only flourish under the utmost freedom. And since marriage is a contract which binds one person to another, these are chains. And by the very fact of putting these chains on, no matter if they loved before, by very virtue of liberty being suppressed, they can no longer be any true love between a man and wife. That is a rather liberated kind of feeling for the 12th century, and I think perhaps not the sort of thing we would have assumed coming up in the Middle Ages. This is why these are so extraordinarily revealing in their own way. And something of this same flavor then goes on to the new kind of epic poem that comes up. And this, of course, is the so-called romance. Now, if all the chansons du geste work around the theme of the court of Charlemagne, the romances all work around the theme of the court of the legendary King Arthur. And the romance as a whole tends to have love and a love relationship as its key element. And that love relationship, in most of them, is adulterous love. Indeed, it goes right along with this other decision. You have only to think of Lancelot and Guinevere as being a very key example, where that perfect knight Lancelot is going to be done in by falling in love with King Arthur's wife Guinevere, and that adulterous love, which neither of them can help, they're swept away on this tide, and what it does is to destroy everything. Tristan and Isolde is perhaps one of the most famous, where you have Tristan, again a perfect knight, who goes over to Ireland to bring back the princess Isolde to his uncle, King Mark of Cornwall. Now, King Mark is a good deal older and not madly attractive, and so he's depending on a love potion to make Isolde love him. He gets there. Love potion goes along, and it is drunk by mistake by Tristan and Isolde. So it's not going to be really their fault if they're hopelessly and helplessly in love. And of course, this goes through all kinds of trials and tribulations. Tristan will go mad at one time, torn between loyalty to his uncle, that is feudal loyalty, and his enormous love for Isolde. Eventually, of course, they're both going to die. There's no way you can have this kind of love and not die. I mean, it just goes with it. If you're going to get tied up with another man's wife, figure that the result will be boring. This is indeed that consistent overtone of Christian morality that will run through things. And indeed, Christian themes will become more and more pervasive. One of the other themes is, of course, the search for the Holy Grail that will enter.
And
this theme of the search for the Holy Grail, as is the cup used at the Last Supper by Christ and the Apostles, is going to become eventually the theme of Parsifal. Only the perfect knight free from sin is going to be able to find the Holy Grail, and this is the other part. All the other knights except Parsifal are going to be done in through falling in love. Once you fall in love, perfection, forget it. It will never do. So there is this persistent touch of Christianity that again runs through all of these various forms. And you have, on the one hand, this concept of the untouchable lady. And this, of course, is a concept which you're going to have a very long life. This is, I suppose, the real beginning of that concept of romantic love, which hardly exists in ancient literature at all, but does come up here. But there is still one other form of literature in the Middle Ages. And this is the so-called fabliau. Now, the fabliau is designed for comedy. The romance, troubadour verse, chanson de geste are all designed for the aristocracy. These will be sung in the castles of the nobles. But people who go to markets and to fairs want to be entertained also. So what you have are traveling singers, acrobats, musicians, people who do all of this kind of thing, jugglers. They're called jongleurs. And they will have a whole separate kind of literature intended now for a middle-class audience. These are usually short stories, and they come in various varieties. The old animal fable will be one of these that survives, and it's told here, where you have Reynard the Fox and the Cock and all the rest of these figures that appear. Another one of the themes that shows up in the fabliau is the theme of being opposed as a whole to monastic life than to the friar. So that you have, in particular, a lot of rather crummy stories told about drunken friars or priests, about them spending too much time eating, not taking up their religious duties, and even getting more involved in other things than that. Almost the first example of this kind of rather funny figure of a friar occurred in Robin Hood. It's Friar Tuck. And if you know the Robin Hood stories, you know that Friar Tuck loves nothing better than a brawl. He's a great one at brawling with his quarterstaff. In addition to this, he eats and drinks constantly, and just before they go off to create trouble somewhere, he gives them a fast blessing, and then off they go to raise hell. That's a perfectly good view of this kind of thing. But the other aspect is that there's quite a different view of the role of women that comes up in the family. Women are not untouchable, and they are not unpedestaled in the family. Women occupy a quite different role. They are, to put it succinctly, no damn good. Indeed, women are the tool of the devil in the family. Women are inevitably terribly clever. If they are married, they cuckold their husbands again and again and again. They cuckold their lovers. They cuckold everybody. You have those long stories where a wife has one boy hid in the cupboard and one in the chest and another under the bed, and the husband comes. She always gets away with it all. And you have this view of women, which is the other extreme from the untouchable lady, produced at exactly the same time. Now, the Fablio also has a very long history. This will finally peek out in such works as Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and in the Decameron by Boccaccio, because these are basically Fablio-type stories that are told that are now reached their final perfection. The stories are very frequently bawdy, but you really never are with the lady. But down at this level, you are. There's that famous one, for instance, that deals with the young man who sees a young nun, and he falls madly in love with her just on looking at her. He has to do something about it. He can't get into the nunnery, so what he does is pretend to be deaf and dumb and to get himself hired into the nunnery as a gardener. Now, this is fine for him, except that beginning with the old lady who runs the nunnery, the abbess, on down, all of the nuns stop and think, and they think, young. And he's a dangerous and he cannot talk at all. He cannot tell anything. He is deaf. He can't hear anything. But we can certainly get him to understand what we have in mind. That's got to be the most tired single gardener. this carries everything together. The view of women, the view of nuns and monks and so on, all of it is tied up in one kind of neat bundle in this kind of story. So that you have, in the Middle Ages, in other words, a very wide variety of concepts and ideas and ideals. They do tend, in part, to be stratified in terms of social caste, that is, town life as opposed to noble life and so on. But at least it indicates that you can't make any terribly fast generalization about such things as a view of women, a view of love, any of these particular factors. They come already in a whole variety of expressions, and they are often very funny. For people, indeed, who have thought of the Middle Ages as being terribly sober at all times when everyone is afraid of the Last Judgment and on their knees praying, stories like this should disillusion you of that. Totally. There are quite other sides of life in the Middle Ages. Now, one of the things that happened with a lot of this literature is that a great deal of it was centered down in the south of France. And the south of France also happened to be the seat of some heresies. Some Waldensian heresy occurred there early on. And then by the 13th century, you have the appearance of the Albigensian heresy. Now, this took over to an extreme degree down in southern France, the very area where Troubadour verse and all the rest of this flourished is exactly the home of the Albigensian heresy. The Albigensian heresy is, in some ways, an oddity. It is Christian, but its ideas stem all the way back to ancient Persia, to Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, are the basic background to this. They tended to believe, as a whole, in the duality between good and evil. And they believed, for instance, that all things of this world, all property, is evil, and that everything to do with the body is evil. So that you have the concept of the body and the spirit, and of divine love as opposed to earthly love, all of these dualities show up in the Albigensian religion. The Albigensians, in fact, believed that one had to do away with all of these things. They attacked the processes of the church on the basis that the church owned property, and the property in itself is evil, and that the church has, in fact, rendered itself corrupt simply by possession of property at all. The property is only of this world and must necessarily then be evil. So they wanted the church to give up all property. They also, of course, believed in fasting. They believed they were vegetarians. For those of you who are interested in wheat germ and alfalfa sprouts, you're right in your setting here with them. They were opposed to eating meat. They also were opposed to any kind of carnal relationship. Indeed, Albigensians came in two classes, those who are the adepts, abandoned meat, sex, and everything else, property, and those who were the lesser figures who would hopefully reach this state. But of course, if carried out perfectly, it would in the long run have been self-defeating, surely. It's the sort of thing that if everyone follows these rules, there aren't going to be any Albigensians left for the next generation at all. Nonetheless, it was viewed with enormous alarm by the church, particularly, of course, by the attack on the church owning property, which is an enormous taboo to the established church, to be attacked on these grounds. And eventually, a papal legate was also killed in a brawl that ensued. Now, the result of this was that the papacy proclaimed a crusade against the heretic Albigensians. And this was a crusade which was indeed encouraged by the King of France because it would lay waste to southern France and give him a chance to make land grabs there. It was encouraged by other persons. Now, the crusade was waged, and it was waged hideously and horribly, if with a certain amount of extraordinary logic at times. It's notable that the crusade is led by a man named Simon de Montfort, and that at one time when they captured the city of Albi, that most of the people in the city rushed into the cathedral for safety from these marauding people who are pillaging and killing. So that when they come to the cathedral, Simon de Montfort's answer is exquisitely logical. He says, kill them all. God will recognize his own. That is logic carried to a somewhat perhaps excessive degree. They did kill Paul. Also, whether God recognized his own or not has not been reported. You must see this as laying waste to this very rich area of southern France. And this is important because, of course, what happens as a result is that all of this culture of southern France is dispersed. The troubadours tend to flee, and they flee down to places like Spain, where they found courts down there, and they flee down to Sicily, and eventually to Italy. And this means that this type of verse is, in fact, carried wherever the troubadours flee from the Albigensian Crusade, and that the culture of southern France itself is nipped in the bud at this point. But the types of verse will continue and will give rise, of course, in the 14th century to such very notable figures as Dante, Petrarch, with his sonnets, his writing pure troubadour verse, or in the 13th century, St. Francis of Assisi, the founder of the Franciscan order, writes some of the most exquisite examples of this kind of poetry. He was himself a troubadour before he gave all of that up and became a saint and founded the order. But perhaps his greatest poem is a poem called The Canticles of the Sun. This is a poem in which he celebrates the relationship of man to the earth around him. And he thinks of all things as pertaining to God and showing God. So that the very first verse of this is dedicated to Brother Sun, who brings us warmth and happiness, all of the good things that Brother Sun brings to us. Then the next one is to Sister Moon, how she likes the dark at night when we need it, all of these factors. Brother Wind is celebrated, all elements of this world. And when finally St. Francis is a very, very old man and knows that he is going to die, he writes an extraordinary final verse to that poem, which is dedicated to Sister Death. And he welcomes Sister Death as eagerly as he had Brother Sun or Sister Moon. It is, I think, one of the most moving single verses in all of medieval literature. So that you have an enormous variety in this literature. And it does point out a variety of ideals and of ideas and concepts. I wouldn't say all of these things represent ideals. However, the literature is a rich tapestry for the Middle Ages. And I am going to devote the rest of the time today to something I promised you, which is a little biography of Eleanor of Aquitaine. Because she also demonstrates a lot of the history of the age. You have met her on crusade. You have met her as a patron of poets, so on. Eleanor, of course, was brought up to this in that very cultivated court, and then she's married to this French prince who is much poorer than she is, remember. She owns vastly greater lands and much more wealth, and she is much more cultured than he is. Remember that he was raised in a monastery and she had been raised in the castle at Bordeaux. So it is not surprising, A, that he fell madly in love with her, and that B, she is somewhat disillusioned with him. So that eventually, after the crusade, as you recall, they have drifted far apart and they don't get back together. He seems to have become more and more disenchanted with Eleanor and her ways and ideas. And so he finally consents to a famous divorce. Now, it is not a true divorce. What it is an annulment. There is no such thing in the Middle Ages as a divorce in our terms. Marriage is simply annulment. And he also agrees to let her have back her entire dowry. Now, this means all of southwestern France. It means Gascony, Aquitaine, Poitou, Angoulême, an enormous, massive territory. She is, again, the richest and the most desirable single match in all of Europe. Indeed, her husband is not precisely nice to her. After the divorce, he refuses to give her any armed troops to take her back to her own territory, and there is a local lord who lies in wait, in fact, hoping to kidnap her and to force her into marriage. She escapes from that by changing into men's clothes and riding hell-bent for leather for Aquitaine and gets away. She then makes a marriage with Henry of Anjou. Now, Henry of Anjou, at this time, owns everything just north of her territory. He owns Maine, Normandy, and some other territories there. He is also the heir to the throne of England. So that this is going to give all of Western France to the King of England, which is going to be extraordinary. He will own and control more of France than does the French king. On the other hand, for his French territories, he must pay homage to the French king, not for England, but for the French territories. So you've got a rather complex feudal position here. Now, Henry is somewhat younger than his Helen, and he is trying to bring order to England, and so for a number of years, he leaves her in complete control of all of his French territories while he rules England. In other words, Eleanor is in a position to rule in her own name, to give justice, to make decisions. She indeed is an extraordinarily efficient woman as a governor here. Henry normally comes over to see her, usually at Poitiers, every Christmas time for about 2 weeks. And every September she has a child. It goes on year in and year out, as a matter of fact, a whole long series of things. So they tend to get along very well on this basis. However, children in this period are betrothed at very tender ages. Anyone who is a major princeling or princess is apt to be engaged by the time they are anything between 2 and 4 years old. When I say marriages are arranged, believe me, they're arranged right down here. So that Eleanor and Henry's oldest son, young Henry, is betrothed, fascinatingly enough, to a daughter of her first husband by his second wife, to a princess of France. And then the second son, Richard, is betrothed to another French princess named Alice. And the French princesses are brought up at the court of Eleanor and Henry. And eventually, after they are into their teens, they are married and so on. Now, the sons of Henry tend to be restless, because Henry himself, by the time he was 15 years old, was ruling territory in his own name and heading armies in battle. And his sons, when they reach this same age, feel they ought to be allowed to do something too. And Henry says, no. No, no, you don't know anything, stupid. He gives them titles and the rest, but they can't do anything. He doesn't. So they become very restive indeed. Eleanor gives all of Aquitaine to her second son, Richard, who is her favorite. And then trouble begins to appear. For one thing, Eleanor is by now getting a little long in the tooth and is no longer capable of having more children. And at the same time, Henry has been looking at that charming young French princess named Alice, who is betrothed to his boy, Richard. And he finds Alice rather a toothsome dish. And the result is that he finally decides, in fact, to marry Alice and to divorce Helen. Since she has already given Aquitaine to Richard, he won't lose anything by this, and he will have Alice, leaving Richard with Aquitaine and no Alice. Now, this this news reaches Eleanor, and Richard is furious, the older boy Henry is furious, all the sons are furious, Daddy is no damn good. And so Eleanor says, all right, you're absolutely right, all of it. He is no damn good, and we'll do something about it. In the first place, Richard, I am taking Aquitaine back. If he thinks he's going to divorce me, the old son of a bitch has got another thought. And she says, you want troubles? You want to rebel against your father? All right. We will. We'll raise armies. And they do indeed. They raise armies in rebellion, and Eleanor goes around raising armies in support, raising French barons to support her and her sons. She is finally captured by Henry. She's riding around, in fact, again, dressed in men's clothes, raising troops to oppose them. So she's thrown in prison. She's taken over to England. She's tossed into imprisonment in the castle at Winchester. Now, she is going to be in prison for the next 17 years. Don't mourn for her too much. She will keep the rebellion of her sons working out of that prison at Winchester for all those 17 years. She will indeed continue to make her husband's life hell on earth for him. Eventually, even the youngest son, John, will be turned against his father, and by this time, the eldest boy, Henry, is dead. And when Henry, I don't really believe this, but I think I must quote it to you. According to the chronicles of the day, Henry, King Henry, is over in France. He is in his castle at Chinon. And when the news is brought to him that his youngest son, the last support he had, John, has joined the rebellion against him, he issues a great moan and turns his face to the wall and dies. He certainly dies. That we know. And indeed, this means that Richard inherits the throne. Now, this is Richard the Lionhearted, whom we've already met going on that third crusade. The first thing that Richard does, of course, is to get Eleanor out of her imprisonment at Winchester. And he then turns the government of all of England and France over to Eleanor and to another lord, because he's going on that famous third crusade. The first thing that Eleanor does is to issue an edict in England, which releases all prisoners from all jails throughout England, because she knows only too well what it means to have been jailed and a prisoner herself. That's a rather nice Eleanor touch, I find. Now, it is Eleanor who raises money to ransom Richard when he is taken to prison. He comes back. Though Richard the Lionhearted is a famous English king, he, I think, spends only about 3 months of his entire kingship in England. He spends the rest of it on the Crusade or in France. And he finally is killed in France, and Eleanor is still alive. Eleanor is a hardy creature. She doesn't stop for a minute. Indeed, in this period, Eleanor, who at the time is in 70, goes all the way down to Spain to bring back a granddaughter of hers, Blanche of Castile, to marry to the heir to the French throne. She arranges marriages everywhere ruthlessly for her children, and a good set of marriages as well. But when Richard dies, the question is, who will inherit the English throne? Will it be, because Richard has no son, will it be the grandson of Eleanor by her third son, Geoffrey of Brittany, or will it be her fourth son, John? Now, Eleanor herself plunks for John's cause, not her grandson's. And she, since this means that there will be war between her own grandson and her son, she now goes out one more time to raise troops to support her son, King John. And in fact, when she is 80 years old, she is trapped in a castle down in the Loire Valley by her grandson.
who comes on with an army and lays siege to that castle. And he proceeds to take all of the castle except the last strong tower, the keep. For Eleanor is holed up with a few surviving men-at-arms. This is exactly like a bad movie. At this marvelous critical moment, who rides over the hill but her son John with his armies to the rescue of Mama, and captures the grandson and releases Eleanor. The grandson is killed off, and that's how he becomes King of England with no problem. And at this point, at 80 years of age, Eleanor finally decides to quit. And she goes now and spends the last 2 years of her life in a nunnery. At Fontevraud, rather nicely enough, it is a nunnery where she has already buried her husband, Henry II, and her favorite son, Richard the Lionheart. And she only dies there at the age of 82. And you must admit, that's a hell of a woman to come down in history. And I think she's absolutely spectacular.